Hostages, WEAA 88.9 FM, your source for cool jazz and the voice of the community. We're looking forward to tonight's guest, tonight's show. We have Dr. Christine Horner, Amir George, Jamila Sabur, and as usual, Keep It Moving is hard-hitting, but not without a little dose of humor and education. Please tune in, or stay on, and we were going to give you... That sounds so ridiculous. Hi, everybody. Stick with us. We've got Dr. Horn here. She is going to share some of her hidden health secrets and tell us all about all the things that are going on with her, newest book. We also will have folks here talking about their upcoming project happening down in Miami, which is going to be a lot of fun. Black Radical Imagination Film Series event in Miami for the 2016 International Tour. And this is being hosted Sunday, November the 6th at 8 p.m., the Miami Beach Cinematheque on Washington Avenue. And it is an evening of film screenings organized by Black Radical Imagination, followed by a conversation and Q&A with curator Amir George and filmmaker Jamila Sabur. Now, you can go on Eventbrite and get all that, but they're going to tell all of that when they come on in the second segment. In the meantime, we're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we'll have Dr. Christian Horner, who's going to discuss not only her latest book, but some really neat things that we can do, ladies. Welcome back to Keep It Moving with Marcia Jews, WEAA 88.9 FM, your source for cool jazz and the voice of the community. Dr. Christine Horner is a nationally known surgeon, author, and professional speaker and holds two board certifications, the National Board of Surgery and the National Board of Plastic Surgery. She was recognized as a leader in her field shortly after starting her plastic and reconstructive surgery practice because she successfully ran a national campaign to pass laws requiring insurance companies to pay for breast reconstruction following mastectomies. Her five-year crusade with the Breast Reconstruction Advocacy Project, BRA Project, led to the passage of an unprecedented federal law that was signed by President Clinton in 1998 requiring insurance companies to pay for this specific procedure. She's an award-winning author of Waking the Warrior Goddess, Dr. Christine Horner's program to protect against and fight breast cancer, third edition, and her newest book, Radiant Health, Ageless Beauty. Doctor, how are you?
I'm doing great. How are you?
Fine. I just had a whole bunch of stuff here and I got overwhelmed. But I'm telling you, you have a lot going on. I'm telling you, I don't know how you have time to breathe.
I actually live a fairly balanced life, if you can believe that.
That's wonderful. We all search for balance because that's a whole different show.
Right.
Trying to find that work life, private life balance is more than a notion. So now, what is this that, what diseases do women tend to keep quiet and why do they do that?
Well, you know, that is actually kind of a problem where a lot of women, when we get various different illnesses, we don't want to share them with family or friends, which can actually be kind of bad because it's always super helpful to have the support, you know, from family and friends when you're dealing with certain illnesses. But, you know, kind of classically, here we are in the last day of Breast Cancer Awareness Month, and definitely breast cancer is one that is extremely common in women, and oftentimes women don't want to talk about it, you know, with their family or friends. There's some stigma with it, and, you know, afraid that people are going to be treating them differently and so forth. Sexually transmitted diseases are another one where, you know, most people really don't want to be talking about those diseases, and HPV, you know, virus is extremely common.
Mm-hmm.
And then mental health issues like depression, you know, is another one where, you know, people really try to keep that hidden.
So But isn't there a danger for women to keep this? I mean, how do you go about not sharing and still be able to function mentally and emotionally? Are we finding stats on that?
Yeah, so, you know, actually what's an amazing thing is that when they do, you know, research looking at all the different factors that affect our health, and so what they found is more than diet, more than smoking, more than genetics, the thing that affects our health and our outcomes of having disease is actually feeling loved and supported.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's the most influential thing. So the opposite of that is not feeling loved and supported,
right.
And that's actually the thing that's hurts your health the very most. So it's really important, you know, to have those that are close to you that are, you know, loving and supportive anyway, you know, to enroll their help. And, of course, you know, in doing so, you also get some additional help and treatment.
Mm-hmm. So if we were to look at that first, let's tackle that whole depression and the psychological, emotional aspect of it. What are some of the things that women should be thinking about before they share this that they normally don't think about?
Well, actually, you know, I was a, you know, Western-trained doctor.
You
described, you know, certified in surgery and plastic surgery. And I got introduced to natural health and particularly the system of medicine called Ayurveda, which really teaches about health. And I didn't learn any of that, you know, when I was in medical school and residencies. And so Western treatments, when we have, you know, situations with chronic diseases, generally speaking, it's not that effective, or they're always turning to medications to, you know, to treat them, and the medications oftentimes have pretty serious side effects. So there's actually lots of different natural approaches for these various different diseases that can have a tremendous impact, and you know, statistically, the studies, you know, show that certain things, like if we're talking about depression, for instance, just exercise actually has been shown to be just as effective as taking, you know, pharmaceutical medications. And then something as simple as a vitamin. So vitamin D, for instance, there's been so much research that's been done on this vitamin in the last decade or so. But what we found is it acts more like a hormone in the body, and it's involved in many, many different functions. And it's also almost universally found to be low in people who have different kind of chronic illnesses. So depression is, you know, one of those examples. You know, breast cancer, you know, is another one. And simply by getting your vitamin D levels up to a dose that we consider, you know, therapeutic, is something that can drastically improve depression and also drastically lower the risk of developing breast cancer.
Hmm.
Now, the only way that you know what your, you know, how much vitamin D you should be taking, and it's pretty much recommended that most people do that because the statistics are about 80% of people are low in vitamin D in the United States. It's a, you know, a vitamin that we can manufacture in our skin, but obviously most of us are not outdoors at the beach all day long, you know, getting our vitamin D. So, so the best way is to actually get your levels checked. And you don't even have to go to a doctor's office for that. There's a website called powerofd.org where you can order this home kit. It comes with instructions, but basically you're just pricking your finger and putting a little drop of blood on there. You send it into the organization, and they will then calculate what your vitamin D levels are and let you know. And then you can determine, you know, how much you need to take, get it rechecked in about 6 months, you know, to see if it's made a difference or if you need to increase it, you know, even more at that point.
So when we sit and talk about a vitamin D, how come all we knew was that vitamin D was in milk, right?
Yeah, it's been fortified, you know, with vitamin D because, you know, again, this is something our bodies can manufacture in our skin, but most of us, as I said, are not getting exposed to adequate amount of sunlight, particularly in the winter months. So, you know, now, as I said, it's really recognized that you need to take it in supplement form, not just in, you know, fortifications of food. And the amount that we thought that you were supposed to take in the past, it turns out to be way, way too low. So it used to be recommended that you take 400 international units of vitamin D a day, but now what's been discovered is that most people need at least 2,000 international units.
Really?
Yeah. And if you are, you know, have a particular particular chronic disease, it may be that you need a lot more than that. I mean, it's not uncommon for physicians to be prescribing 5,000, units or even more to get a person's vitamin D levels back up.
So is this vitamin D working on, it restores the cells or something in the different organs? What does it,
so it works,
do specifically?
It works in many different ways because, like I said, what we're recognizing is that it actually works more like a hormone.
Okay.
And so it has effects virtually in every cell in your body and many, many different things that it does. So it really has dozens and dozens of different functions. But it's, I would just say overall, super important for cells to function optimally.
Mm-hmm.
And, we found that definitely is something that's important in a bunch of different chronic illnesses as well as, depression.
Right. So now when we look at your, what you are looking at specifically in your specialty is mm-hmm. the female organs, would you say, primarily?
Yeah, so, I would say that I definitely have a specialty in women's health issues,
mm-hmm.
and particularly breast cancer. My first book that came out, Waking the Warrior Goddess,
yes.
that came out about 10 years ago, and I've actually done 3 editions, since that time, adding, lots of research, because
mm-hmm.
we've really had an explosion of research, in this area. So one of my, specialties is helping women to lower the risk of developing breast cancer. But in addition to that, other more female-type diseases, and then just helping with healthy aging and creating extraordinary health, really, because, as I said, when I did my training and medical school and residencies, I certainly did not learn anything about health. So there's definitely a need for that.
Mm-hmm. So I guess when I'm surprised, and maybe I don't know why, but all of a sudden it seems like there's a big burst of breast cancer among women and men. Is it that it was just lying dormant, or are there certain things or conditions?
Yeah, so actually what the statistics are is that the incidence of breast cancer continued to climb rather alarmingly up until about 2002 or 2003. And at that time, the Women's Health Initiative study came out, which showed a link between breast cancer and hormone replacement therapy.
Mm-hmm.
So the prescribing practices kind of changed overnight, and what they found is the following year there was a 7% reduction in the incidence of breast cancer. The following year after that, there was another 7% reduction. So now the levels of breast cancer has actually been pretty stable
okay.
for the last, number of years, but still, way too high. Compared to what it should be. And again, this is one of my areas of my passion, because as I went through the medical research, I really discovered exactly why we have a breast cancer epidemic, everything we're doing to contribute to it, and the things that we traditionally don't do in this culture that are highly protective.
Such as?
They're all natural. The food, supplements, lifestyle. In fact, 95% of the cases of breast cancer are thought to be preventable just through diet and lifestyle alone. So all the, kind of fast foods that we eat and
mm-hmm.
and the American diet is really a recipe for breast cancer, prostate cancer, colon cancer. It's one of the reasons we see, such high incidences in it. Favoring a plant-based diet is something that's been shown to be extremely protective. All the vegetables and fruits and so forth have many different properties to them that, help to lower the risk. And there's certain ones that are particularly protective, like cruciferous vegetables. So that's the
I can't even pronounce that. What? What did you say?
Cruciferous vegetables. Yeah.
What is that?
So it's a family of about 18 different vegetables, and it includes broccoli, cauliflower, kale, Brussels sprouts,
mm-hmm.
bok choy. They don't seem like they may be related, but if you cut through the stem
okay.
of those plants, there's a cross there, which is why they call it cruciferous.
Okay.
So cruciferous, relates to that. But they have many different chemicals in them that have anti-cancer properties to them, and they find if people eat eat these types of vegetables regularly, they have about a 50% lower incidence of developing breast cancer.
Isn't that interesting?
Yeah, and there's, you know, other kind of specialty, really interesting kind of specialty, you know, spices and foods that, you know, can make a tremendous difference. So one thing is we found that medicinal mushrooms are the type of food that helps to support the immune system more than anything else.
But those aren't the psychedelic mushrooms.
No, unfortunately they're not. So actually what they found is that we form cancer cells all the time. It's kind of a normal part of our physiology.
Okay.
And if our immune system is strong, those cells will recognize it and eliminate it. And it's only when something happens in our immune system where it gets weakened, and usually that comes from severe stress, or it can come from a bad diet, like eating sugar.
Okay.
It's something that just knocks out the immune system. In fact, you get a 90% reduction in the effectiveness of your immune system for 5 hours after eating, you know, a high sugary meal.
Hmm.
So there, but you can actually help to keep your immune system strong by consuming mushrooms, but, you know, particular ones that can be really effective. And you know, here's a situation where it's like, are you going to eat, you know, therapeutic doses of medicinal mushrooms every day? No, you're not going to.
Okay.
So there's a place where it's actually makes sense to take some supplements so that you can get, you know, the protection from it. And
mm-hmm.
so I kind of looked at all the different kinds of mushroom supplements, and the one I've been most impressed with is one that's out of Japan called AHCC. And it stands for Active Hexose Correlated Compound, which is why we call it AHCC.
Mm-hmm.
But they've done a lot of studies, in fact, over 100 studies, looking at the effectiveness of it with the immune system, and they find that it helps to support every single cell type in the immune system, and does it so effectively that it dramatically lowers the risk of breast cancer, prostate cancer, colon cancer, liver cancers, melanomas, you know, a number of different kinds of cancers. And also very impressively, what they found is that if you have any of these cancers, that your survival statistics are actually much better if you take AHCC. So they actually prescribe AHCC in the hospitals in Japan. If you get cancer there, you know, you'll definitely be treated with it. So, you know, for me, it's a really great thing to just take on a regular basis to keep your immune system strong. And speaking of which, they just did some research out of MD Anderson and University of Texas, and they found that they tested it against the HPV virus,
yes,
which we know is something that can help to cause cervical cancer. And in most instances, the 98% of people will clear that virus themselves. If there's something with their immune system, then they won't. And if somebody gets a chronic HPV infection, there's actually no Western treatment that's effective at getting rid of it.
Huh.
So what they did at MD Anderson and is that they tested the HPV virus against this mushroom formula, AHCC. They found that AHCC killed it, and so then they tested it on women, you know, in a clinical study on women who had this chronic HPV infection, which, again, there's no effective Western
right.
medicine treatment for it. And so what they found is that all the women they gave it to at 6 months, they were completely cleared
wow.
of the virus. So they're doing a much bigger study, you know, on that to get the accurate statistics. But I think it's super exciting where you have, you know.
It is exciting. It
yeah.
is exciting. And I have a very interesting, I'm just sitting here. You went through regular medical school training, right?
I did, yeah.
And so I just find, I'm listening to you, and I'm listening to you talk about this homeopathic, natural type of care and management. And
mm-hmm.
so how did you translate that or make that transition? Because you're still Western educated, right? And
right.
How, what occurred for you to be where you are with this now?
Sure.
That's a powerful message.
Yeah, so what happened was in my practice, my patients were getting younger and younger until finally I started doing breast reconstructive surgery for breast cancer in women in their 20s.
Wow.
Now, I was like, okay, something's way wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And then my own mom got breast cancer and died from it within 9 months.
Mm-hmm.
So that was really, you know, the impetus for me where I thought, okay, I'm going to look, you know, through the medical research and see if I can find anything that, you know, women can do that can help to lower the risk. And as I said, I literally found thousands of studies. So then I was introduced to Ayurveda, the traditional system of medicine from India that really is all about teaching you about health. And as I learned that, I thought, you know, people really need to know this information. So I pitched the television stations in Cincinnati, Ohio, where I used to live, to have me be the on-air doctor on the newscast talking about complementary and alternative medicine. And this is way before Dr. Oz, back in 1999, 2000 or so.
Okay.
And, yeah, so
paved the way.
I did that. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I did that for 3 years, and it got syndicated nationwide. And in order for me to do that, as well as my practice, I was working 14 hours a day, 7 days a week. And, yeah, as you can imagine, I woke up one day and went, oh, I can't do this anymore. So that's when I decided to leave my practice and really dedicate myself full time to teaching people about how to become and stay healthy naturally and avoid the knife.
Right.
Because we really do have the answers.
And that is really powerful, because there's so many people who are going through this process, and it's devastating to even go through it, or just the process of even getting to the doctor to acknowledge that you have a lump, or to acknowledge that there's something wrong, and you know your body. So I think that, you know, the fact that this was so important and vital for you is really, really critical. Now, you have a more recent book, The Radiant Health, Ageless Beauty. Talk to us about this book. And unfortunately, ladies and gentlemen, I haven't had a chance to read the book, but I'm going to read the book. They're going to send it to me, and we're going to have some follow-up with you, Dr. Horn, on this.
Great. That sounds wonderful. Yeah, so my new book came out in March, and it's really, you know, my intention of it was to really be a guidebook that touches on all the things that are most important for you to achieve extraordinary health and longevity. So it's just kind of all the different elements, you know, that are involved. And, again, much of it is like diet and lifestyle and exercise and sleep. So sleeping at the proper times.
What's a proper time? Because, you know, high-powered women don't have a sleep time proper time. What is that?
Well, they actually found that if you go to bed before 10 o'clock and you get up by 6 o'clock, that are the optimal hours for you to sleep. And it all has to do with hormonal balances. So, you know, we start to get sleepy in the evening as it starts to get dark outside. Our sleep hormone, melatonin, will start to rise. If we go to bed by 10 o'clock, there's a spike in melatonin that occurs between midnight and 2 a.m. that you absolutely don't want to miss, because if you do, the consequences are really spectacular. So melatonin is not only a sleep hormone, it's also a powerful antioxidant. It regulates estrogen in the body. It helps to support the immune system. Hmm. And it also interacts with all sorts of other hormones. So basically what they found is if you stay up to midnight on a regular basis, your risk of diabetes, obesity, certain cancers, and heart disease are twice as high.
Wow.
So, like I said, it's pretty spectacular. So here's something you can do that's free and simple, and just back your bedtime up, you know, before 10 and get up before 6 o'clock. And most people find that they have lots more energy, you know, when they're sleeping during those particular hours.
And I'm wide awake between 12 and 2. I mean, I'm so wide awake, I could just go outside, play basketball or something ridiculous. It's ridiculous. It's ridiculous.
What time do you go to bed?
Well, you know, I start laying down around 11.
Uh-huh.
And I'm wired until about 2:30, 3 o'clock. Or I might go to sleep around 9, but then I'll wake up at 1.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then I'm up for 3 hours.
Reasons. Yeah, there's some reasons for that. And within your physiology, what happens is your liver actually goes into overdrive at around 2 a.m. So a lot of people wake up, you know, during that time. And according to Ayurveda, they recognize different energies, we'll call them, that govern different hours throughout the day. And so they actually prescribe different herbs that don't give you any kind of hangover or anything, that specifically helps to calm the imbalances that you have that cause you to wake up in the middle of the night.
Mm. Okay. So we need to find those things that... Now, somebody was saying that you should even take melatonin.
What they found is that melatonin has some really powerful anti-cancer properties to it, and so it's actually considered part of the treatment plan in, like, the Cancer Treatment Centers of America.
Mm-hmm.
They find that it enhances the effectiveness of chemotherapy while taking away some of the side effects and really has a significant improvement in survival statistics. So it's actually prescribed for cancer patients. But if you have, problems falling asleep, I mean, it's an excellent sleep aid to take because it, helps get your melatonin levels up and again, usually doesn't give you any kind of hangover or anything.
I love it. We're out of time.
How'd that happen?
I don't know, because you're so interesting. So this means that I'm going to get the book, and we're going to have you come back. And then maybe when you come back, we could do some Q&As with the audience and
sure.
let them call in.
That'd be great.
And in the meantime, we're going to do an offline. I have your number. I'm going to call you and just talk about a couple little things that I would just enjoy with you.
Sure.
So now tell us, you've got some ways for people to be in touch with you if they wanted to. Do you have a website?
Yeah, so the best way to get a hold of me is my website, which is drchristinehorner.com. It's drchristinehorner.com. I got a free newsletter on there and all sorts of kind of tips and tricks, and I also offer telephone consultations for people that, want some personalized coaching regarding their health or, particularly for breast cancer patients, too, to help them with an integrative approach.
So what is that number? How did they get in touch with you for the...
So it's all on my website.
Okay.
That's the best way to
Very
do that.
Very good.
Yeah.
And that manages that call and everything.
Correct. Uh-huh.
Outstanding. Dr. Christine Horn, I'm telling you, this has been very exciting. Author of Waking the Warrior, as well as her new book, Radiant Health, Ageless Beauty. And she's just a wealth of knowledge. Thank you so much. And it's drchristinehorn.com. All right. Take care.
Okay. Thanks.
You're listening to Keep It Moving with Marcia Jews, WEAA 88.9 FM, your source for cool jazz and the voice of the community. Come on back. We're going to talk about the arts now and what's going on down in Miami. Welcome back to Keep It Moving with Marcia Jews, WEAA 88.9 FM, your source for cool jazz and more. Well, I'll tell you, this is really exciting. I just learned about the Black Radical Imagination, and they have a free film screening organized by Black Radical Imagination, a whole evening followed by a conversation and Q&A with the curator Amir George and filmmaker Jamila Sabur. And it's presented in Miami by Art Center South Florida. It's coming up on the 6th of November, and this should be a lot of fun. We have with us tonight... we're very excited about it. We have Amir George, who's a motion picture artist and film programmer, born and bred in Chicago. Amir creates work for the cinema, installation, and live performances, and his motion picture work and curated programs have been screened in festivals and galleries nationally and internationally. And he's the founder of Cinema Culture, a grassroots film programming organization. He's currently manifesting his latest short film, Decadent Asylum. That sounds interesting. Amir, how you doing?
I'm doing great, Marshall. How are you?
I'm great. I'm excited about what you all are doing. You're going to have to bring it up here somehow. So on Sunday, you've got the Black Radical Imagination, and it's an international touring program of experimental short films emphasizing new stories from within the African diaspora. And it's curated by you and Aaron Cristobal. That delves into the worlds of new media, video art, and experimental narrative. What brought this on?
Well, me and Aaron are pretty much like film programmers.
Well, what's a film programmer? Because I've never heard that term before.
Well, a film programmer is a person who basically organizes like a film festival, like picks films for that, pretty much like seeks out films for like public like programs and things like that.
Okay.
So we both like have been doing that for about like a few years, like independently, and we were actually introduced through like a mutual friend in Chicago who like suggested we like meet, and we had some conversations. It's pretty much about things we like weren't seeing on the screen, the representations of black people, and also like a temporary like experimental films.
Okay, all right.
So we decided to like create this program and also like make it like a tour.
Oh, I love it. So you said, okay, we're going to do this, and we're just going to make it happen. How did you select the films that you were going to use?
Well, we have like several different ways we go about like selecting films. Mostly, they are like filmmakers of like work we already like follow.
Okay.
And we've like been in contact with, and people like who have already like reached out to us. So it's like pretty much a whole like variation of things. We've done about like 5 programs, and we've done a few like specially curated programs. And the Arts Center of like South Florida had been like reaching out to us like a little while ago, and we decided to like put these films together on my Florida exhibition.
I love it. So hold on, Amir, because we have one of the film producers, Jamila Sabour, who is on the line, and she is an artist working across various disciplines, including performance, video, and installations. And she was born in St. Andrew's Parish in Jamaica, and she received her MFA in visual arts from the University of California, San Diego, and her BFA from the Maryland Institute College of Art. I'm loving that. In interdisciplinary sculpture in 2009, she's interested in embodied cognition, social mimicry, dissonance, ritual, and the uncanny. She lives and works in Miami. Hi, Jamila. Do we have Jamila on?
Hello.
Hi, great. There you are. How you doing?
I am doing well. I'm really excited to speak to you. Thanks for having us.
Oh, I'm really excited, especially when I saw that you went to Micah, girl. I was like, oh, she's a home girl. Yay!
Baltimore. I describe Baltimore as sort of my first love and forever love. I really, really, really love Baltimore.
Oh, and Micah's a wonderful school.
Mm-hmm.
It's a wonderful school.
Live on Druid Hill Avenue and Madison Avenue. Yeah.
Oh, I love it. So you really got a good sense of Baltimore and who we are.
Yes, I miss the people, the sound, the colors, the textures. I worked with Creative Alliance and Canton
Wonderful.
Middle School. So yeah, it was definitely a big part of.
So Amir sees you. She's gonna have to bring you up here. You all gonna have to bring all this up to Baltimore. You cannot bring this up to Baltimore. We're gonna have to have a conversation about this. So Jamila, now you have a piece in here, right?
I do.
Talk to us about it.
Sure. So I have a piece. It's a short experimental film called Medical Gaze, and it's a part of a trilogy of other short works where I use choreography to shape my ideas about ritual and the sense of dissonance that I'm really interested in. I'm really interested in this sense of fragmentation, fragmented moments, fragmented realities, and Medical Gaze that's screening at Art Center. I describe as a sort of love letter to fear. It's a piece about a part of Jamaican identity that is so ingrained in my being on an almost pathological level, the fear of lizards, particularly the croaking lizard, a lizard from the gecko family.
What's specific about that lizard that?
So it's really big.
It's really big.
So, you know, it's definitely, you know, just growing up, you know, my mother was afraid of lizards. My sister, you know, some of my brothers, my uncles, you know, I still have a fear of lizards. Mm-hmm. And, you know, for this particular piece, I with the title Medical Gaze, the philosopher and social theorist Michel Foucault coined that term medical gaze to denote this sort of dehumanizing medical separation of the patient's body from the patient's identity. And
right.
It was this term from a text called The Birth of a Clinic. And, you know, within that text, it's a sort of history of the clinic and medical perception. And it's presented more as a sort of, you know, I think of it as this history of, like, human experience, the experience of politics, bodies, and systems. And, you know, like, located within that, I begin to think about and look at language, and, you know, coming back to this idea of this kind of obsession of this fear, you know, becomes this almost kind of, yeah, this thing that's kind of pathological, and, you know, how that's, like, displaced from the body.
Like having out-of-body experiences.
Right. Mm-hmm. You know, and this, you know, within this video, I was, you know, thinking about this, you know, this idea of sort of this displacement and this kind of pathological sense, and playing with this sense of, like, objectification, you know, to, again, meld this idea of the objectified body, the displaced body, with this the psychology of fear. You know, fear is something universal, yet it's highly individualized.
Mm-hmm.
So the lizards, and now fear is cultural. You know, like, I think about, what is it like when an entire culture shares this fear?
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, where does this fear come from? So medical gaze, you know, it's definitely a meditation and all of these thoughts. And a little bit about the structure of the film. So it's definitely nonlinear. You know, a figure finds himself in a space where they're afraid to check their mail
mm-hmm.
because they're afraid to see lizards in the mailbox. It definitely becomes this kind of whimsical, sort of uncanny portrait of this figure trying to overcome fear. And then within that, I composed a soundtrack where I recorded myself reciting the verses from this famous 1976 Jamaican reggae song by Max Romeo and Lee Scratch Perry called Chase the Devil.
Mm-hmm.
So there's so much within this piece.
Right. So Amir, I guess you're still with us?
Yes.
And so when you looked at these films, you're making this, I mean, I love what Jamila said, and I can understand having this phobia, right?
Yeah.
And what did you look at when you were making these decisions to bring this particular piece into the fold?
It was a piece that, like Jamila, that made us aware of a little while ago, actually. But we always think about how these films like work together,
okay.
and how they form like one overall conversation. In this case, it's dealing with like identity with the other films,
mm-hmm.
and it's dealing with also like myth, which are all themes that we had are like playing off of in this program, in addition to Afro surrealism and other things like that. So it just like worked with all the other films that we were thinking about.
So you have two other films, The Golden Chain and Field Notes, right? And how do they integrate, or how do they play off of one another?
Well, they all have, like the film The Golden Chain is basically about like Yoruban like creation myth,
mm-hmm.
And Field Notes deals with the like myths of what's called like the Jambi, but it's like the zombie, but you know, in like the Caribbean, is pronounced like like Jambi. So it's someone like questioning like those myths,
mm-hmm.
and like how they exist. And I think that the like Jamila's film pretty much like relates to those two as this like personal story,
mm-hmm.
And just looking at like a gaze.
Right. Well, hold on, Amir. What we're going to do is we need to deal with the sound, and I'm going to go to Jamila. And Jamila, when you looked at, and the studio is going to talk to you, Amir. Jamila, when you looked at the other two movies, how did you see the fit?
Sure.
Did you want to see a fit, or?
No, there's definitely again this relationship of this sort of surrealist landscape within all of these works by the filmmakers.
Mm-hmm.
I really love Vashti Harrison's Field Notes. You know, she's Trinidadian. There's definitely this relationship of the sort of Caribbean architecture language that we share.
Mm-hmm.
So there's something with her work I really feel is in conversation. I love this quote by Juno Diaz, and who's sort of making this reference about sort of Caribbean sci-fi and this idea of who's more sci-fi than us, the Caribbean, just thinking about these sort of experiences and again with these sort of surreal textures and stories and moments. I feel like it's a conversation that I definitely am really excited. Amir and Aaron have really taken on and they're really pushing these works into a larger conversation,
mm-hmm.
Thinking about the sort of surreal aesthetic from the Black perspective is really necessary and bringing it back to the work that'll be at Art Center South Florida, especially, in Florida, I definitely think it's again a really necessary piece of the puzzle.
Why is it so necessary?
Well,
in South Florida,
I think when we think of particularly Miami as this as the sort of largest immigrant population, and just these stories, I definitely feel just like within the arts, we often think about representation.
Mm-hmm.
How many women are in exhibitions, or how many women filmmakers, and then we think of how many Black women, Black
right.
artists are represented, and with within this conversation, in a place like Miami,
right? It's so Hispanic, really.
It's definitely just sort of building. So I mean, recently. I've been spending a lot of time looking at Afro-Cuban filmmaker Sarah Gomez, and it's something being here and just kind of thinking about the relationship of her sort of narrative documentary exploring the conflicting threads racial and gender identity within a kind of revolutionary context, thinking about the that kind of conversation coming from some, an Afro-Cuban in Miami. It's definitely something I want to see more of. I want to be a part of. And the screening at Art Center, South Florida, is definitely sort of creating that kind of space.
So the location itself sounds like it is very integral to what you all are doing. Is that correct?
I believe so. I think so.
Mm-hmm. Amir?
Yeah. The location being Miami, giving space to these films,
mm-hmm.
And they haven't shown pretty much in Miami at all.
Say that another way. What does that mean? Say that another.
They haven't premiered in Miami.
Okay.
So this would be premieres.
Mm-hmm. So now the other one is The Golden Chain. And what is that film?
It's made by two animators,
mm-hmm.
Pretty much Ezra Clayton Daniels and also Buki Bodorin. It was based off like an original project that they did that was involved in our very first program, and this is like a longer version of that. But it tells the story of this like woman in space. And, like, it's also like an animated film. It tells the story of this woman in space and how she's just trying to like communicate to like people back on Earth. Just with her like discoveries and around creation. The creation myth is based off of. Has to do with like man being made of sand, and a golden chain coming down from the sky. I don't really know it exactly, but it's all those things together. But it's a very very beautiful film that the two of them end up like putting together.
Mm-hmm. What did you and your partner think about when you all were pulling this together? What did you want the takeaways? You know, films are so personal, right? And in looking at who your audience is and where it's located, it's in the heart of Miami. Miami's this hotbed of art and, you know, parties and all things that are wonderful, right? And so who are the people that you want to see it, and what is it that you want them to take away from these films?
Well, with like any of our screenings, we want people to walk away with having like experience these like different like forms of filmmaking. All the films are really like distinctly different, and not a lot of people get exposed to pretty much like experimental film, especially experimental film that's made like by Black people. So thinking about Miami, and I only know somewhat about how it is, and just thinking about the culture of it, and just like the mixing of all the different like cultures down there,
mm-hmm.
and how these films, how the people down there could possibly like relate to the themes and the stories that are offered in these films.
Mm-hmm. So, and these are all shorts. So you're going to be able to, the people who attend are going to be able to sit in the room and within an hour or so, or I guess what, within an hour, they'll have had the experience of three different films. And and then you're going to have a Q&A after. So all of the filmmakers are going to be there, and then you and your partner are going to talk as well or answer questions?
Me and Jamila
will
be there.
All right.
So I guess it'll be like a longer version of this interview.
Maybe I should come down and interview you all in person.
Sure.
Yeah.
So the question then, too, for me is that when the notion of the Black radical imagination. Talk to me about that term. I love that.
Well, it was a title that stemmed from a book by Robin D.G. Kelly called like Freedom Dreams, the Black Radical Imagination. And basically in that book, he talks about how these different like social movements were born from one's like imagination.
Mm-hmm.
So, and how they expanded out to be so many things. So we thought about the like power of that and the power of imagination being like Black experimental filmmakers and wanting to have a broader range of like representation of ourselves and of different artists that we also like admire. So it's really like an expansive term that basically represents like all the films.
Mm-hmm. When you look at that term, because that really kind of stuck with me, and I had to try to process it in my head, because as we look at the landscape now and everything that is all part of it, there's such a need for expression from so many different people who didn't even think that they needed to have the expression, right?
Right. Right. Well, I guess like you could look even at the word like radical itself, which means like getting to the root. So me and Aaron started doing this. We were looking at how there aren't any representations of these like Black experimental filmmakers, or there isn't any outlet like of these like works made under this medium, and trying to, and also thinking about how Black people have been treated just right. in cinema,
right.
and the image we've seen ourselves and the access
right.
we've had to great films,
right.
and have them like shown in the public. So, so that's what we're interested in, and that's our goal as like curators to like give more exposure, like to these artists of color who are pretty much like making great films.
And I think that's really wonderful. So when we start talking about, you know, all of the limitations that have historically been given to people of color, how do we create this as the explosion, as the ignition, the light to get people who have all of these creative ideas in their mind to be able to see that there's this incredible outlet for that? So you become that, it's not the Sundance, but you become this other entity that allows the entrance of so many different bodies of work.
Yeah, we act as a like a conduit.
Yes.
Between these working artists and also like the institutions that we have been in and the different organizations we like collaborate with. Very honored and very fortunate for the Art Center of South Florida and like Domingo and Natalia and the great like work that all of them are doing with a great show and asking us to be a part of it to allow us to like share these stories with everyone.
Mm-hmm. And so is this going to be an ongoing relationship down there? And are you, and I wasn't joking because, you know, Baltimore is a hotbed for.
Yeah, we actually were in like Salisbury, Maryland a little while ago.
But didn't nobody know you were down in Salisbury.
Yeah, I know. No one knew we were in Salisbury.
People in Salisbury knew you were there.
Well,
but I think that's a wonderful thing in order for us to be able to have this experience and know, because our show reaches so many different places. When we talk about, Jamila, when you accepted this challenge to submit your work, what were you thinking when you made the submission before you even got accepted or anything, just the decision to make the submission?
Right. Well, I've worked with Amir and Aaron in the past. They curated a screening at the Brooklyn Museum last year.
Oh, nice.
I really just love them and love what they're doing. They've really just taken on something that is radical and inspiring. And, you know, when Amir reached out to me, I was like, of course, I'd love to be a part of anything that they do. So it was definitely, you know, it felt really, you know, I feel really honored
right.
to be a part of what they're working on. And, you know, it's really exciting.
Is this one of the first pieces that you've done?
No. I've made a few short films, mm-hmm. and this particular piece, Medical Gaze, is earlier I was describing it as a part of a trilogy. So there are two other short films that are in sort of direct conversation,
mm-hmm.
and the other two pieces are called Playing Possum and Moon Tendon. But with Medical Gaze, it's my first time. Showing it.
I love it. Oh, that's wonderful. So, Amir.
Yes.
When you look at the next steps for us to make sure that we get everybody down, it's we're coming up on the end of the hour. This was quick. I just had two shows, and they're both just wonderful. You know, you can always tell when it's good because the time goes so quickly. How do people get tickets? Who do they contact? What do they do? I mean, you've got some incredible works. What I know that they have to go to Eventbrite to get it, but can you give people information on how to participate with the Black Radical Imagination?
Well, we have a website, which is like blackradicalimagination.com.
Okay.
We're also like on Facebook, and we like post updates of like what we're doing and everything. But I want to say like we don't really operate on like a submission based thing. It's more of just like knowing these films and knowing who and how do we like have access to them and the people and like within our network we like reached out to. But we do encourage people to like send us working on just to like take a look or like get some feedback, or and also like possibly to like be considered in a future program. But I know that there's a like Facebook event for it. The like screening on Sunday, and yeah, I guess people should just like look up everything else. It's happening. At the Miami Beach Cinematheque. I'm not sure how anything else is like working around that.
Okay. Well, I'll tell you also, for those of you, if you go to Keep It Moving Marcia Jews on Facebook, you will find today's newsletter. Go to the bottom. We've got a link that'll take you straight to Eventbrite. That's Keep It Moving Marcia Jews. We're on Facebook, and you'll find the link in there, and you can find us on Marcia Jews on Twitter. Jamila, Amir, we got to go. But thank you so much. Break a leg on the 6th. We know it's going to be fabulous. We're going to stay in touch.
Thank you so much.
Take care. Thank you so much. You're listening to Keep It Moving with Marcia Jews, WEAA 88.9 FM, your source for cool jazz and more. Thank you so much for listening. And all our Keep It Moving team, Sandy, Shaka, Brandon, Iori, Andre, Michael, Meredith, and we hope you enjoyed our show. Ask that you subscribe to our weekly newsletter at keepitmovingmarciajews@gmail.com. Like us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. This is Marcia Jews, WEAA 88.9 FM, your station for cool jazz and the voice of the community. Until next week, remember to keep it moving.